This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to my good friend, Malcolm Margolin, who's the founder of Heyday Books, also an author of many, many really wonderful books, one of which is called The Ohlone Way, and another very recently, a kind of collaborative memoir called The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin. Malcolm, how are you? It's really good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, old friend. So we've both hung in for so many years. It's been marvelous. It's been marvelous that the world is letting us get away with this, David.
I agree. It is a miracle and a joy. And it's great to have a chance to talk to you. We don't see each other that often, and I've always enjoyed the opportunity.
Me too. In a way, we were little mates.
That's a good way of looking at it, I think.
We've gone our separate ways, but we were little mates back then.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I want to talk a little bit, or I want you to talk about Heyday. It's a publishing, an independent press. You're based in Berkeley. You've been there for over 40 years, but you're an East Coast person. Originally, you're from Boston. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, the early days, how you got out to California. What prompted you to end up in, or what were the circumstances that kind of led you to be, become this? Now you're a real Berkeley, California figure. You've been there a long time. You probably know more about California than 99% of the people who grew up there.
I'm afraid so.
Yeah, how did you get there?
So back in the mid-60s, I was living in New York off Tompkins Square, where all good people should be living. We're all artists and all writers, and it was the most marvelous intellectual, creative ferment. The East Village of it had just begun. There was all that political stuff going on. There was all these cultural changes, and I was so happy in the off on East 10th Street. And I was living with my wife, Rena, and we're still married after 50 years. But I was living with her, and we wanted to have kids. And she couldn't figure out how you have kids in New York City. So she wanted to see other parts of the country, and I thought I would indulge her. I thought I would do my due diligence. We'd get out into the world. We'd see other parts of the country. We'd discover that there was no other place except New York where human beings should live. And then we could move back to New York and be done with it. So I went to the Queens. I got a bus for $300, a VW bus. And we went across the country in this $300 VW bus and came out west and visited some friends and saw Berkeley. And then spent a couple of years in that VW bus living on beaches in Mexico, living in beaches in Canada, wandering around in the late 60s. And in 1970, my first kid was born, so we settled into Berkeley for a while to have a kid. And then, I guess, almost 50 years passed.
As if by magic.
And maybe in some ways I'm still just passing through. I mean, there was a sense of impermanence to it, and there was a sense that I didn't like Berkeley all that much. Other people talk about falling in love with it. But there was a wonderful thing that my friend, the East Indian writer, Chitra Devakaruni, said, where in America you fall in love and get married, in India you get married and then fall in love. And there was something about Berkeley that was it was almost like an arranged marriage. It was convenience. We moved here to have a kid. We moved here because there were friends in a library. And then the longer I stayed here, the more the whole thing grew on me, the more the landscape grew on me. I began to write about the landscape. I began to write about the Indians that I met around here. I began to get into the deeper history of the place. And there's something that grew out of it that has been the joy of my life.
Well,
And it's something so far off the main street of America that it has almost no, it lives in a world of its own.
Well, I think for a lot of people, I mean, Berkeley has attracted and enabled so many people to do things without, it just seems that it's enabled a diversity that has had a kind of unplanned messiness, but also a cooperative approach. And I think, you know, that seems to be part of your story as well, that, you know, in that period in the 60s, early 70s, a lot of people like you were inspired to write and publish who had not thought of that as being necessarily a career path. It was just an expression of what they were doing at the time.
Yeah, David, do you remember Fred Cody?
Absolutely.
So Fred Cody had Cody's Bookstore, and it was the center of culture in Berkeley. If I had a choice of saving the UC Berkeley campus or saving Cody's Bookstore, I think I would have saved Cody's Bookstore if it was that Sophie's Choice, because this is where the intellectual ferment was. This is where people would gather, and this is where the ideas seemed to be. And what Fred talked about was how during the free speech movement and the political activism of the 60s, intellectuals, for the first time, had to get stuff out. And at the same time, there was a revolution in typesetting and in paste-up, so that a person with moderate skills could put something, get something printed and put it out quickly. So all of these intellectuals began to do manifestos and posters, and a whole bunch of print stuff came out of Berkeley in the late 60s. And it created a kind of writer-publisher. There was Bob Callahan of Turtle Island Press. There was Don Cushman at the West Coast Print Center, who was a poet, and he had his own press. It was Cloud Marauder Press. There was Ishmael Reed that came in and had his own press, I Read Books. There were all these people around that were writers and at the same time publishers. And there was something about Berkeley, it was the late 60s cult of self-sufficiency. And I've always said that I made every error a person could possibly make except one. I never went out into Mendocino to raise goats. But my self-sufficiency was publishing my own books, of not wanting to work for anybody else, of fixing my own VW with that wonderful book, VW Repair for the Complete Idiot. And there was something about both the communal spirit of Berkeley, about a rebellion on every possible level, on family structure, on food, on education, on livelihood, on how you looked. And there was a sense of changing the whole world. We're going to change the whole world. And yet, at the same time, there was this communal spirit. There was also something that was marvelously self-sufficient and independent. And I'm not sure we're going to get that combination again.
No, I mean, I always think in that period, I think of the Whole Earth catalog, because it, when you read it, you would read about people doing what you're just describing on almost any level. You know, if you were interested in publishing, there would be tools for how to publish books and things you would just didn't know you could do. And it just, it, that whole ethos seems to have been part of the, you know, inspired so many people.
It inspired so many people, and it was directly responsible for my getting into publishing. That in, I think in 1972, I got a grant for $2,000 through the Whole Earth catalog, through Stuart Brand and Huey Johnson, to write a book that I ended up selling to Houghton Mifflin for $10,000. And this allowed me to start Heyday and do my own books. But it came from the Whole Earth catalog.
Right, And then there also was the, as you mentioned, the print center, Don Cushman, who created essentially tools that would help people who wanted to learn how to publish.
Were you responsible for that, David?
No, not at all. But certainly I remember, you know, I was involved in some peripheral ways.
I remember you were involved. I said you were involved with it with the NEA.
Well, the NEA, the Print Center was a grantee and did receive funds from the NEA. And, you know, I was there at one point, but I think Print Center was going before and going after I was there. So, but definitely what they were doing was a powerful driver, I think, for a lot of publishing activity in the Bay Area.
So Don Cushman had this West Coast Print Center that was printing other people's books and teaching other people how to print. And there was this whole sense of taking control of the machine, as it was then thought of. And So he was a poet, he was a publisher, and he was a printer. And he has the funniest story about somebody from another press, a magazine, brought him their magazine to print. And in that magazine was a lousy review of one of his books that he had, that he had written. And he was having to print this lousy review and do the best possible craftsman-like job of making the print clear and making the whole thing attractive. And he talked about the marvelous conflict that he was in.
So were you also involved in those early days with book people?
Of course. Of course I was. Of course. How could you be? How could you live in Brooklyn and not be involved with book people? So my memory of book people was in those early days. I published my first book in 1974. And you'd go down to book people and you tried to arrive somewhere around 10:30 in the morning. Because if you came any earlier, they hadn't arrived yet. And if you came much past 11, they were all stoned. But there's a moment of lucidity in there between 10 and 10:30, 10 and 11, where you could actually get something done. And the fact that this place survived, David, I've seen miracles in my life, but this was just extraordinary. And there was an ebullience to it, and there was a sense of fun to it all. There was a sense of excitement. There was a sense there was the possibility that you could make a big splash in the world without having to sell out, that you could be with people of your own kind, and your people of your own kind, you could succeed.
Yeah. Well, for me, Book People was not only a model for how to do complicated work, you know, really important work, and to enjoy doing that kind of hard labor that makes it's what goes on behind the scenes in almost any publishing endeavor. But also they were inspirational because they were they were just fantastic. Yeah. Employee owned, employee run. As you said, ebullient would be the word. The energy level there was incredible.
The energy level, the sense of fun, and the sense of porosity. There was an openness to that place. Anybody would walk. You could walk in. There was always lunch available. They had somebody cooking for them there, and there was a sense of excitement. There was a sense of a new book coming in, and a whole new way of thinking would come in. I mean, at that time, there was all this stuff coming in about Tibet and about. And there was a whole lot of New Age stuff that was coming in about astrology and women's witches and stuff like that. And the way they accepted it with this kind of openness, you had the feeling that anything would go over there. Right, one of these places where you walk in and there are narrow rules and narrow walls and a sense of no. When you walk in there, there was a sense of yes.
No, that's exactly right. I think that's very important that they were open and that if you came in with something interesting or new, they would respond. They weren't inventing everything. They were enabling. And that was a really powerful driver, I think. And I think for you, they were very interested in the idea of the local and of the community and the place where you are. So a lot of, they really were very supportive of publishers who were in the Bay Area, who were publishing books about the Bay Area for the people of the Bay Area. That was important to them, as it was important to you.
Yeah, it was. And at that time, Book People was only one of, there were a number of other distributors around. There was LS in the city. Do you remember LS?
I do, yeah.
So...
And did you, when you were publishing, at the very beginning of Heyday, you were publishing, it was your own books, correct?
Yeah.
And you were writing mostly about the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And so did you hand carry your books into places like LS and Book People and, that was an important part of your distribution, but I assume you also would go into the bookstores to themselves. And, aside from Cody's, there were so many bookstores in Berkeley and then San Francisco and the peninsula. I mean, it was incredibly full of book culture.
it was lousy with bookstores. There were so many bookstores around, and it was just such a delight. And I'd go in there, and this was the days before barcodes. This was the days before, if Ingram was around, they were a small player. I don't quite remember them from those days. And everything was personal. You'd go into this a bookstore, and it would be somebody would own the bookstore. A person that owned the bookstore would be there, and you'd sell them some books, and maybe they'd put it on the front table. And maybe you could get a check right away. And there was something about that world of personal bookstores, and it was a world of personal publishers. All the publishers around here had built something around the quirks and the beauties of their own personalities. And every one of them was different. And every one of these bookstores that you went into was built around some personality and built around somebody's vision and somebody's dream. And you'd go in there and you'd talk to them, and it was like entering somebody's kitchen. And you'd sell them some books on a person-to-person basis. And I remember when I was thinking about it the other day when barcodes first came in, and you had to put barcodes on the back of your books. We now take this totally for granted. But back then, we were so appalled at this. They were telling us what we had to put on our book. They were telling, and then they were going to measure the sales of these books with these things called computers. And they were going to order according to this abstract system rather than go into there and talk to Audrey at Ben Franklin's Books or Fred at Cody's or Lucas at Lucas Bookstore. Instead of talking to somebody and putting the books on the table, there were now going to be these ordering systems. And it seemed like the end of the world at that time.
Well, it's interesting to me. You know, I was always pretty favorably inclined to computers, and I still am. But I realized, at the time when I was selling books to bookstores, you'd go into a bookstore and the people in the store had to memorize where all the books were.
Yeah.
They knew the stock. They knew the inventory was real to them because they had put it on the shelf. And the only way to know where a book was to remember. And when you got inventory systems, then they became much more efficient, but people forgot where they put the books because the computer remembered. Or they didn't really know the books in the same way because now they were abstracted to a level of being information on a report. And so I think that's what you maybe recognized was going to happen, is what you're talking about, that for a lot of us it was kind of, well, this is just more efficiency and it will make things easier. As you said, with the barcode, you can scan it and it's quicker to sell the book and it's quicker to keep track of it. And then we when we're out of books, it's more efficient because we'll reorder more quickly. But the loss then is of the personal contact with the physical object.
Yeah, and the loss also was that I've always had a larger personal presence than I have had an economic presence. So when I come into a place, somebody knows me, we have a beautiful book, they love the book, they think very highly of this book until you look at the goddamn numbers. And what that barcode, what those barcodes allowed them to do is now look at the numbers. You could record the sales more easily. And you now started ordering by numbers, not by the people you liked and what you liked. And that was not quite my world.
So, but you during the last period of time, despite all of this change, Heyday has published a lot of books, and you've gone from being this sort of self, in a learning environment where you learned how to make books. You now know how to make beautiful books. I mean, the books that Heyday produced in 1974, 1980, if you stack them up against the books that you're producing today, today's books are absolutely beautiful. You've done so many books that are incredibly representative of California culture on such a diverse level of subjects. Is it possible you couldn't have done it without all of this technology changing things to what it is today.
Oh, I suppose. I suppose. I mean, hey, listen, back in 1974, those first ugly books that I did were the most beautiful books I knew how to do. My knowledge has increased. The people around me are better. I'm still doing the most beautiful books that I know how to do because that's all I know how to do. And I think it's partly pride in what I do. It's partly shame, David. If somebody gives me years of their work to put out and I did a slovenly job, if the cover was off, if the type was lousy, if there were typos in it, I would feel ashamed of myself. And you just don't do that to people. You just, somebody gives you something of value and you treat it as something of value. We're a nonprofit. Did you know that?
I did know that. And I wanted to ask you about that. What year did you decide to become a nonprofit?
I think that it was somewhere around 2003 that I officially changed the whole thing into a nonprofit. In the years before that, I set up a kind of support organization that would launder grants for me and give them over. And it was legal. I'm using the word launder in a kind of descriptive way rather than a legal term. But I set up something that whose sole function was to support Hay Day's mission. And that was a nonprofit getting grants. And then in 2003, I turned the whole thing into a nonprofit. So I've got a board of directors. And the board of directors, we just had our 40th anniversary. They threw an amazing party for me. We raised close to $1 million.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that's big money.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Well, you're not alone in converting to a nonprofit. I think it suits the goals of many independent publishers whose missions are either spiritual or literary or political or cultural. And I think it probably has the benefit of enabling you to build the structure, like having a board of directors that creates continuity.
Yeah, you can build a structure, and it also allows you to get individual donors and grants, and this allows you to do things that are not necessarily commercially viable. Or it allows you to take something that would be commercially viable at one level and turn it into something magnificent.
So would you identify today, it seems to me that I'm guessing that your mission and goals are not altogether that different than they've been between now and your earlier years. But how do you say what the goal of Hay Day Books is today?
To keep me from having to get another job. That's a prime goal.
Well, that's a pretty good goal. But
yeah, no, I've been successful at that goal.
Yeah, right, for 40 years.
It's for 40 years. So back in 1972, I was working for somebody. They fired me, and I resolved never to work for anybody again. And I haven't. So it's partly, but you know, there's an irony in this. I started publishing my own books to be, as part of that self-sufficiency. I started publishing to be totally independent. I was never going to work for anybody. I was going to be a totally free man. And I've been striving for freedom for 40 years now. The result is I've got a board of directors that I'm dependent on. I've got a staff that I'm dependent on. I've got donors and foundations that I'm dependent on.
Right.
I've got sales reps and bookstores that I'm dependent on. I'm the most completely dependent person you've ever met. And the other word for that is community, and I'm really proud of it.
Right. Isn't it an interesting lesson to learn that this is going to sound really trite, but to be truly free means to be dependent on a community.
Yeah, I think that certainly has been my experience. I think the mission, the way I view my work in here is we've got about 12, people working here. And I spend a lot of time outside the office. And my job is to bring back things that thrill the people that are working on them. And it looks like we shape books, but the books we work on shape us. And it's shaped an office that is so full of laughter and so full of joy and so full of a kind of warmth and kindness. And this is what I want to do, is I want to create a working environment like this. And as long as we can hold that one together, we can get beautiful stuff out in the world. If it's pinched, if it's ugly, if it's at all narrowly self-concerned, if it doesn't have that element of porosity and playfulness, and we're doing books on truth and beauty and literature and stuff like that, with frauds, and I'd shut it down in a minute.
Do you still feel strong? I mean, I think you do, but I guess I just want to ask this. Is the sense of place, the sense of being a California publisher, still in kind of infusing what you do?
Yeah, but it's not necessarily California. If that VW bus had gotten stuck in Indiana, I'd be the best publisher in Indiana. It has to do with myopia. It has to do with I do what's in front of me. I relate to who's in front of me, and it has to do with I'm an emotion junkie. I just love to get involved in things that are emotional. I love to get involved in small groups of people. I love to get involved in particular places, not because it's a California place, but because it's a scale that I can get involved in. Because there's something in that scale that's great. I'm a California publisher because I'm here in California.
Right. But it's so interesting, you know, California is so massive and covers so much territory. It's kind of amazing to me. You know, you could be a California publisher, but of course, a California publisher could be doing work that in any other part of the country would be, it can't be local anywhere else because California is so big and so diverse.
Yeah. So back in 1849, a bunch of alcoholics got together in Monterey and they drew the boundaries of the state. And they drew boundaries on a map. Most of them had never been to any of these places. They drew boundaries on a map and they created this thing called California that has absolutely no relationship to culture, no relationship to geography, no relationship to environment, that the deserts have nothing to do with the coast, the mountains have nothing to do with the valleys, that we did a flora of the Santa Ana River in Southern California. It was a comprehensive flora of the plants that grow along the Santa Ana River. My wonderful friend Oscar Clark had been working on this for 68 years, and we finally pulled it out of him and did a flora of the Santa Ana River. Up in the Redwoods, we've got somebody named Kim Haler, who's been working now for about 12 years on a flora of the Redwoods. These are both California environments. I'm not sure there's a single plant that can be found in both of them.
Oh, that is an incredible thought. Well, and you know, if you think about California biogeographically, it's probably hundreds and hundreds of different bioregions. You know, you could kind of map out the state and end up with a completely different version of how people should live there if you followed the geography, the biogeography of California.
So maybe it's the edge effect. Maybe that you end up having the greatest fertility and abundance, not in the center of an ecotone, but in the edges, where it meets some other ecotone. And maybe there are so many edges in California that you end up having this kind of marvelous complexity of culture, of lands, of people.
Yeah. Well, and you've spent a lot of time with Native Americans in the Indians of California. Again, a very diverse set of cultures that you know, in some ways would be as distinctive as the description you just gave between Santa Ana River and Redwood. I mean, Indians who lived in San Diego have no relationship to Indians who lived in, let's say, you know, Lassen, Mount Lassen in that area. So, but you know probably as much as anybody about the complexity and diversity of cultures, both living and past, in Californian American Indian culture.
Yeah, this has been the great and surprising gift of my life, is to hang around these people. So there were about 100 languages spoken in California that were distinct languages. There were about 500 independent political groups that you could call tribes. There was a diversity of living that was so amazing. And when I first got into this stuff in the early 70s, there were people that I knew who had been born in the 1890s, who had been brought up by people that remembered California before the gold rush. So there were people that had been brought up by people who remembered that old world, and they had about them that marvelous sense of bigness, of sweetness of soul, of violence. I don't know how sweetness and soul and violence can exist in the same time in the same people, but it's there. They had this marvelous sense of nobility, of belonging, had an understanding of poisonings, of the way the world worked through shamans and poisonings and stuff. There were people that had a sense of humor that can only be born of the deepest defeat. They were the most amazing people that I'd ever come across. And I started a magazine in 1987 to interview them and to capture those memories. And that magazine became the center of a whole revival movement, of language revival, of people getting in touch with one another through it. And the way I summed it all up is that I came to deliver a eulogy, and I found myself present at a birth.
And that's really beautiful. And how are you still involved with those works, I should say, or those people?
Of course. Of course I am. This is not my profession. These are my friends. We've got people working here. We've got something called the California Roundhouse, which is, and we've got these people, these native people that are working downstairs, that I've got we do a magazine, we do events, we do books. We had a poetry slam in California native languages, and we ended up having this Nishinan rock group come. The Nishinan lived around Auburn in gold country, and they were doing a rock opera on the gold rush in the Nishinan language.
Wow. And
the stuff that was going on around here was just so astonishing. And when I first got into it, the languages were in decline, and you only heard these languages through the mouths of very old people. And there was a they used them for religious ceremonies, maybe. There was a piety to it all. There's been a language revival. Young people are making up songs. They're making up poems. They're dissing one another in Indian languages. The language has come alive and has been revived.
How many Native American languages are still spoken in California?
Yeah, I'm not sure. We try to figure it out, but it's difficult. I'm not sure when a language dies. Does a language die when there's one speaker left and nobody to hear it? Does a language die when somebody has a knowledge of some of the words but not all of the words? So I'm not sure when a language is alive or when a language is extinct. And we try to figure it out. We've done some surveys. And it always gets into philosophical conundrums. But there are probably about, we helped start a master apprentice program of people that would go off and study with elders and live with them for 3 or 4 months. And we helped fund them to do this. And we had a linguist go around and give them tutorial lessons on how to cover different tenses and different situations and how to record things. And there are probably about 50 or 60 languages spoken from that language program. We've got one guy working for us, Vincent Medina, who's 28 years old. He relearned the Chechenyo Ohlone language of the East Bay from wax cylinder recordings that his ancestors had left behind in the 1930s. The last two speakers of this wonderful language left behind some wax cylinder recordings and some notes in case anybody ever wanted to know what their language was like. And he's picked it up. He speaks it with fluency. He's teaching it to others.
That is fantastic. I love the idea that you can bring a language back to life. That's a pretty incredible thing to do.
And when the language and the language comes back, and other things come back with it, the customs come back, dance comes back, attitudes come back.
Well, because a language is not separate and distinct from its culture, and therefore, if a language is being spoken, then the culture has to be participated in as well.
Yeah, it gives a whole new way of seeing things.
Oh, that's great. Have you ever yourself learned to speak any of these language or any words or any terms in these languages or any of them?
Well, I know terms in them here and there, but I don't really speak any of them.
Is it difficult, do you think, for a non-native to learn, and particularly difficult, or is it just that in order to learn the language, you have to spend so much time with people and live in the culture?
It's like any other language. It takes you just as long to learn Chumash as it does to learn French, although the systems are somewhat different. So one of the master apprentice teams that we helped get together was Georgina Troll, who was a Yurok woman from the Klamath River, and she was upper-class Yurok. She was tall. And the upper-class Yurok spoke a different kind of Yurok from the lower-class Yurok. And she was the last of the full speakers of this upper-class language. And we wanted to get her an apprentice, but she wouldn't take any apprentice from the lower classes. We had to find somebody that was well-born. We finally found this woman, Carol Korb, who was well-born. I think she came from the house of Sha'ah in Requa. And we introduced her to Georgiana, and Georgiana had known her grandparents, and she was acceptable. So we got them together. A little while later, I meet Carol, and I say, "How's it going?" And she says, "It's the most degrading experience of my life." And I said, "What happened?" He says, "I'm sitting there." He says, "I've been up there for 3 months and I'm still learning how to count." And I said, "What the hell do you mean you're learning how to count?" He says, "I'm still learning how to count, Malcolm. There are 21 different ways of counting in Yurok, depending on what's being counted." And Georgiana will say something like, "How do you say three flowers?" And I'd say three flowers, and she'll say, "Oh, no. You can't say it that way. If you say it that way, bad things will happen." So you end up with a language with 21 different ways of counting, depending on what's being counted. It's such an amazing concept that numbers, that we have a system of numbers that joins everything. They have a system of numbers that recognizes the uniqueness of everything. In Yurok, there's no word for tree. You cannot say a tree. You have to say the species of the tree. And if you don't know the species of the tree, you just can't say it.
Yeah.
There's a specificity. And there's a specificity to property rights, to marriage customs. There are three different classes of money up there. There's money for religious ceremonies. There's money for social ceremonies. There's money for everyday things. And the whole thing is just so marvelously complex.
That's great. So are you writing? Do you have any books in progress that you're working on now?
Well, I've been writing. We're a nonprofit, so there's a kind of fiction writing that I do called grant proposals. and that keeps me in trim.
Right. That's pretty serious writing, I think.
You know, it's the most successful writing that I've ever done, and it's good writing. It's good. I actually like it. I actually like taking something of amplitude and complexity and summing it up and attaching it to time and money and people's interests. I just love these complex orchestrations. I write a lot of introductions to things. I'm not writing any major books. I just finished an introduction to Ernest Kallenbach's Ecotopia.
Oh, yeah. That was a great... And so are you republishing that book?
Yeah, we got that book out.
That's fantastic.
So Ernest was a dear friend, and this is the 40th anniversary of that book.
No, that was an important book for me. I remember it. Well, I think you've done... It's hard to sum up. We've talked for 40 minutes. I think we could probably talk a lot longer, but there's so many things you've done, it's impossible to try to talk about them all in a short period of time. But I guess let me ask you one more question. So from the perspective that you have today, when you kind of, you can, now you can be one of those, you know, like the people you were talking about who grew up as in the experience of elders who had memories going back, let's say. So we, you know, you can think, you know, in a way you can serve that same role today because your memory and your experience can reach back quite a number of years. If you're thinking about the future from today, you know, in terms of publishing, what do you foresee being the next most, you know, what are the important things that people need to know today based on the experience that you've had over the last 40 years?
Beats me.
I'm looking for you to be profound here.
let me give it a shot. I think that in some ways, nothing has changed. Somebody sits there for 3 years alone and writes something. At the other end of it is somebody sitting in a chair alone and reading it. There's this sense of a one-on-one communication. The stuff that's gone on in the middle that gets it from the writer to the reader has changed. But the basic act has not changed all that much. There's editing, there's design, there's connecting it to the person and finding the person. People are talking about all the great changes, and I've seen a lot of changes, but the core of it is still the same. One of the things that's happened is that the computers have taken over the conveyance of information. Books no longer have to carry information. If I want to know something, I go to Wikipedia, I go to Google, I go somewhere else. I don't go to books. What books have taken on is another function, and it's an artistic function, and it's a function of stature. It's a function of... There's something about the physicality of them that gives them a kind of presence in the world. There's something about the care that goes into them, the fact that you can't change it, the commitment to what's on the page. And I think that people are talking about, people keep telling me that I'm making buggy whips. And the allusion is to the time when automobiles were taking over from horses, and a whole bunch of places, stables and blacksmith shops and buggy whip manufacturers, were all going out of business, and a new breed of people were coming in. And yet horses are still around. They no longer haul freight. They no longer have drudgery. They're now free to be beautiful creatures. They're now free to have to be raced and to have young girls worship them. And I think that books are going to become more art objects, and I think they're going to become more status objects. I think they're going to and I think they're going to become monuments to art, that when somebody wants to say something big, they do a book. When they want to just convey information, they do something else. I've watched the physical book decline in presence. My father worked for a trucking company. He worked as a rate clerk for a long time. And you ended up having these volumes of books on rates. When you go into an automobile parts store, you have volumes of books on auto parts. You go into a lawyer's office, there are all kinds of books. This world of books is deteriorating around us on the fringes, and it's getting closer and closer to the artistic center. But in the middle of it all is something that I think will last for a long time as art objects. And I think that the bookstores of the future are not going to be books, the general bookstores of today. I think they're going to be cultural centers. I think they're going to be places where they're going to be refugia. They're going to be places of refuge for the intellect. They're going to be places, they're going to be clubs. And I think this whole nonprofit thing that I followed, where I become more of a cultural organization than a publisher, I'm a cultural organization that publishes books. And I think bookstores are going to be cultural organizations that sell books. I think the whole thing is going to become something that will be I think it will work in a different social scale. The reason I'm stumbling around right now, the books that are being produced right now are spectacular, David. I go into bookstores, I see what people are doing. I see the quality of the work. I see the quality of the intelligence. It's just utterly awesome. But the whole thing depends on subsidy. And it's not just grants from foundations. It's the subsidy of authors who believe so much in what they're doing that they'll work for 3 years without any hope of getting paid for it. Young, wonderful, intelligent people that come to work for publishers at low wages. People that work in bookstores for low wages. The few newspapers that still subsidize book review sections. The whole thing is a massive subsidy that's built on belief. And if this belief decays, then the whole thing is screwed. And yet, on the other hand, I don't see any decline in the belief. I go to these conventions. My judgment of whether an enterprise is healthy or not is its capacity to attract beautiful young women. And publishing is still in good shape.
That's perfect. Malcolm, thank you so much for talking to me about everything. It's just been terrific. I really enjoyed it.
David, for almost 40 years now, whenever we've talked, it's been terrific.
Well, I hope there'll be another 40 at least, or at least something approaching 40, maybe not 40 literally, but...
Hey, at this rate of deterioration, let's make it sooner.
Yeah. So this has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've had the great pleasure of talking to Malcolm Margolin about Heyday Books. Thanks, Malcolm.